At the same time, the expansion of his own facilities meant he'd long since found it necessary to create a formal training process for managers and supervisors, and overriding the passive resistance of several of his own senior subordinates to include women hadn't been any harder than, swimming across Howell Bay, the long way. He'd managed it, though, and so had they, he thought, with a glow of pride. And the rest of the world had damned well better get used to it, he reflected now as Wilson joined him, looking out the office's windows at the enormous work floor. We'll still be a lot more of a muscle-powered society than I wish we could be for decades to come. That's what happens when you can't use electricity without finding yourself ground zero for a meteor strike. But we'll be a lot less of a muscle-powered society. My workforce is already close to 30% female, a lot higher in places like the instrument and pistol shops, and a lot lower in places like the coking ovens or coal mines, and that percentage is only likely to grow as we get more of Pater's machine tools into operation, and that'll let us free up still more manpower for military duty. His lips twitched in amusement as he remembered Narman Bates's enthusiastic discussion of someone called Rosie the Riveter he'd found in Owl's archives. But then the incipient smile faded as he gazed out at the busy workers. If they're good enough to build rifles and hand grenades and revolvers, they're good enough to supervise the process too. And if my competitors and the Temple decide not to follow suit, screw 'em. Last time I checked, at least half the human race were women, and that means at least half the human race's smart, competent people also happen to be female. As certain individuals with names like Charlian, Iris, and Ivor Parson, or Nimu Albon, might be said to demonstrate, if they're stupid enough to deprive themselves of that human resource, they deserve what's going to happen to them in the end. That's even more impressive than it is noisy, Wilson said quietly. And a lot of the credit goes to you, Hausman pointed out. You do realize we have a revolver coming off that line every 8 minutes? That's 1,000 every 5 day, and 6,000 per month. The second line goes into operation sometime next 5 day, and the third one comes online the middle of next month. When they're all up and running, we'll be producing somewhere around 180,000 pistols a year. Even Wilson looked shocked by the numbers, and Hausman laughed. Then he sobered a little. Actually, we won't hit quite those numbers until we get the new forging machinery into full operation in another 2 or 3 months. I could hold the numbers up on the revolvers, but I'll have to divert a lot of my present forging and stamping capacity to the new rifles when those lines go into operation. I'll turn out as many pistols as I can in the interim, and then I'll switch a lot of the people you see out there to the rifle lines and shut down at least one of the pistol lines until we have the additional forges up. We're already well along in converting old-style Mondrains to the trapdoor design. At the moment, we're converting about 200 per day, and I expect to have the first M96 line up within 2 5-days. Based on our experience with the pistols, I'm projecting around 140 M96s per line per day, which works out to 700 per 5-day. The second line should come on stream a couple of 5 days after that, and we should have all three of them in operation by the end of November or early February. At that time, we'll be churning out over 2,000 every 5 day.
Wilson inhaled deeply. He'd had access to the numbers from Hausman's reports, but that was different from looking down on that swarming work floor.
That comes to 126,000 per year, he said very carefully.
Yes, it does, Hausman agreed with simple pride. And we'll be phasing in production at the Lake Lyman Works as soon as we can. Ultimately, we expect to have 3 lines operating there, too, and by the end of March, we should have all 3 pistol lines back in full operation. I've already crated up the machine tools to set up rifle and pistol shops at Michaelsburg, and we're sending along the plans to duplicate the original tool set. We hope to have a total of 5 rifle lines and a pair of pistol lines there within 4 or 5 months. Once all of that's up and running, we'll be producing close to 300,000 revolvers and almost 460,000 rifles per year.
And you'll be able to keep them supplied with ammunition?
Wilson couldn't quite keep a certain skepticism out of his tone, and Hausman grinned.
Cartridge production's actually running ahead of projections. At the moment, we're turning out roughly 200 cartridges per hour, and we'll be upping that to around 1,000 in the next couple of 5 days. There's no point producing them faster than that just yet, because the cartridge filling machinery developed a glitch we hadn't expected, and we're still putting the fix for it into place. By next spring, we'll be able to produce and fill 2,000 per hour, or just under 1.6 million a month. We won't be able to increase much beyond that, assuming we have to, until we can produce the primer compounds in sufficient quantity.
Wilson only shook his head, and Hausman patted him on the shoulder.
You'll get used to it once it's had time to sink in, Father Pater. In the meantime,
he turned the priest away from the window towards the pot of hot chocolate steaming gently on the small stove in one corner of the office.
I'm certain Mistress Simpson and Master Christopherson can be convinced to join us in a celebratory repast.
He uncovered a large platter, revealing a serious stack of doughnuts, and grinned.
I'm sure this'll be much better for us than any of that dreadful champagne and whiskey.
Sir Patrick Hywitt stood on the quarterdeck of HMS King Timothy, watching something no Carisian admiral, in fact, no Safeholdian admiral, had ever seen or dreamed of seeing. The unlikely, unlovely, ungainly craft forging steadily into Thesmar Bay looked much the worse for wear. The paint had been scoured away from its blunt bows and the curved front of its rust-streaked casemate. The falls of its davits were strained taut over emptiness where the hungry sea had snatched away the boats which ought to have ridden in them. Its signal mast had been reduced to a broken stub, and its starboard funnel was half the height of its companion. He would not have wagered a tenth mark on its ability to survive the southwester which had gone howling up the Tarot Channel 3 5 days ago, yet there it was, trailing a smoky banner from those battered funnels. And greater miracle even than that was the crippled galleon following at the end of her tow, foremast and mainmast little more than stubs, a scrap of canvas set under her broken bowsprit, and showing only the mizzen topsail aft, although a stay had been rigged from the mizzen top to what was left of the mainmast and a staysail set upon it. HMS Tellisburg Queen, Hywitt thought. Two ships he'd been certain had been lost when the first units of the storm-threshed convoy straggled into Thesmar. And yet here they were, Halcombe Barnes's ship and the 1,000 men whose lives he'd saved aboard the galleon. Guns began to thud all around the anchorage, saluting the victors they'd never expected to see. Hywitt hadn't ordered that salute, but he wasn't the least bit surprised when King Timothy's guns joined it. Sir Howard Braegart stood atop the lookout tower high above the center of the town of Thesmar and watched the Miracle steam towards the docks. Unlike Hywitt, the Earl of Hanth was no sailor. But he was a very experienced marine. He knew the terror when the sea's full wrath descended upon the frail works of man in open waters, and he'd no more expected ever to see those ships alive than the admiral had. He stood very still, leaning both hands on the tower's railing, as he contemplated those ships and breathed a silent, fervent prayer of thanks, and not just for the lives HMS Delthac had saved. That battered galleon, the water sluicing from her pumps even now, contained not simply Brigadier James Matheson's artillery battalion, but also half the scout snipers assigned to the 4th Infantry Brigade. The guns would be crucial to Hanth's ability to carry out his orders, and he was devoutly glad to see them. Yet he was even more grateful for those scout snipers. He straightened, jaw tightening, as he recalled how many men had been less fortunate than those aboard Tellisburg Queen, Men for whom there'd been no miracle named Delthak and no miracle worker named Halcom Barnes. Colonel Ludovic Overton's 8th Regiment, half of the 4th Brigade's infantry, had lost one of its 3 battalions in its entirety. Nobody knew where or when Amelia's Pride had lost her battle, but she'd taken over 1,000 ICA men and officers to her grave with her. There'd been eyes to see, but no way to help, when the brig Lady of Erastor foundered in the fury which had claimed too many of her larger, stronger sisters, and 2 precious batteries of rifled 4-inch guns, and the gunners to serve them, had gone with her. And then there'd been Spindrift, driven onto the jagged reefs from which Rock Island took its name. Colonel Rafe Albertson, the 2nd Scout Sniper Regiment's commanding officer, had drowned while fighting to get his men ashore, and so had Major Alec Stevenson and over 80% of his battalion. Major Dennis Macklemore, commanding the 2nd Scout Sniper's 2nd Battalion, embarked in Tellisburg Queen, didn't know it yet, but he and his battalion had just become the only scout snipers attached to the Thesmar garrison. It was a grim tally, and they still didn't know the fates of 3 supply ships, but at least they'd accounted for all the transports now, one way or the other. And Delthak herself was an incredibly reassuring addition to their defenses.
"And despite everything, you're in one hell of a lot better shape than you were, Howard," he reminded himself.
Thesmar's garrison now numbered over 30,000. Emperor Caleb and the Lord Protector had decreed that Hanth would retain command, and General Summers and General Figuera accepted that without any resentment he could see. Brigadier Matheson's 8,200 men were the largest single component, and, combined with Braegart's 1st Independent Marine Brigade and Hywitt's naval gunners, totaled more than half of Thesmar's strength, despite the losses the troop convoy had suffered. Summers and Figuera knew that, just as they knew they would never have held Thesmar once the Royal Dalaran army crossed the frontier without Karras. And even more to the point, they realized they had no experience with Karizian doctrine or weapons. That was changing. Both of them had gotten behind the joint training with Hanth's own brigade, and now that Matheson had arrived, they'd all be taking advantage of the training opportunity that offered. His own Marines and Navy battalions could use all the polish they could get, and he especially wanted Matheson's troops to spend time with the Sidermarkians. Every single one of them was a volunteer who'd stood firm in the face of the hurricane which had swept over their republic. They'd been tried in the furnace, and Hanth's men had come to admire them deeply, and to trust them implicitly. He wanted Matheson's men to do the same.
"And you also want the opportunity to pick Matheson's brain," he reminded himself. "You were a colonel, a marine colonel, before the Emperor recalled you. What the hell do you know about maneuvering an entire army brigade?" he snorted harshly. "I think that's something you'd better learn in a hurry, Howard. And it won't hurt a thing for you and Matheson to figure out how best to combine Clifton and Kidrick's troops with your own. A third of them have muzzleloaders, and another third of them have matchlocks or arbalests. At least none of them are hauling pikes around anymore."
True, and at least the Lord Protector and Seneschal Parkair had managed to scrape up enough Sidermarkian-made rifles to equip another 5,000 of the South March militia units.
"And you've got a month or so before you have to show Richter and his boys all your new toys, too. Isn't that nice?"
"I hadn't expected to see you again, Master Slater," Sir Reynos Alvarez said.
"Didn't expect to see you again either, my lord,"
Japheth Slater said frankly, wrapping his gnarly, knuckled hands gratefully around the mug of hot tea.
"That Colonel Kerbish, though, he can be a mite forceful."
"So it would appear, and a determined fellow, too."
"Might say that,"
Slater acknowledged laconically, and Alvarez favored him with a smile. The dispatch Slatier had just delivered was the first real good news he'd received since leaving Thesmar. Despite Father Nicholas's grim final dispatch, almost a quarter of Larrae's Walkyr's garrison had cut its way out through the understrength Sidermarkian regiments east of O'Hodlan's Gap under Colonel Bryan Kurbish. The understated tone of Kurbish's message barely hinted at what must have been a desperate fight, but the colonel hadn't simply settled for escaping. Instead, he was in the process of rallying the faithful of Shiloh to his standard, and he proposed to operate against the heretic's rear in any way he could. It wasn't clear to Alvarez just how much the Shilohan might be able to achieve, but he obviously intended to achieve everything he possibly could.
"Duke Carlos would be pleased to hear about this too, Master Slatier," he said, listening to the rain drumming on the overhead canvas once again.
"Can't say as I care a whole heapin' lot about his high and mightiness," the Sidermarkian replied sourly. "Damn near got me killed sending me back last time. Colonel Kurbish, no. He's one a man could warm to."
"He sounds like it," Alvarez acknowledged, trying dutifully not to smile at the Shilohan Mountaineer's obvious dislike for Harless. From Slater's expression, he was pretty sure he'd failed.
"Sending you back, though, gets us to this suggestion of the colonel's," he continued after a moment. "Tell me whether or not you think you could do it without getting killed before I pass it along to his grace."
Slater gazed at him for a long moment, brown eyes thoughtful, then shrugged.
"Long's it's just me and no more'n one pack mule, two at the outside, I think I can do her, my lord. Mind, I can't promise, but I expect the odds be fair."
Alvarez considered that statement carefully, only too well aware of the risk the Sidermarkian was willing to assume. He'd already used his local knowledge to bypass Carizian pickets three times. To get home, he'd have to do it yet again, and each additional horse or mule eroded his chances. Adding portable wyvern coops to the mix could only raise the odds against him, yet he was still willing to try.
"Very well, Master Slater," he said finally. "I'll pass the colonel's suggestion along to the Duke. But I'm afraid," he smiled faintly, "that it will take me several hours, five or six at least, and probably more, to get word to him and for his response to reach us here. Why don't you go with Captain Latimer here and let him find you a dry spot to catch a few hours' sleep while you wait?"
"Appreciate that, my lord," Slater said, and Alvarez looked at his aide.
"See to it that we feed Master Slater a good hot meal too, Lincoln. Then get him bedded down. By the time you've done that, I'll have drafted the letter to Duke Harless."
"I feel almost guilty," Merlin Athrawes realized with a certain bemusement. His Pika's transformation back from Japheth Slater's gray hair and brown eyes was nearly complete, and he glanced over his shoulder at the pair of well-laden pack mules following obediently along behind his horse. In another 20 minutes or so, he'd be far enough out from the army of Shiloh to feel comfortable summoning the stealthed air lorry, despite the wet, cloudy daylight. I'll be damned if that bastard Alvarez might not have an actual human being hiding somewhere inside, he thought, then cautioned himself against an excess of fancifulness. Given how little love there was between Alvarez and Harless, it was entirely possible the Dolaran's consideration for a commonly born Sidermarkian had more to do with planting one in Harless's eye than any sudden effusion of human kindness. Still, it was possible he and Narman were being overly clever this time, but it was definitely worth a try, and Narman had become extremely fond of an ancient Old Earth aphorism: "If you aren't cheating, you aren't trying hard enough." By Merlin's estimate, Russell Therese's strategy had an excellent chance of success as it stood, but it never hurt to nudge the odds along. Which was exactly what Colonel Bryan Kurbish's wyvern-born messages to the Duke of Harless
should do. November, Year of God, 896. Chapter 1. Fort Terrace, the South March Lands, Republic of Sidermark.
Took them long enough, Duke Eastchair murmured to himself, looking down from the same hilltop from which he'd watched the bombardment of Fort Terrace. The hilltop was still the same. O'Hodlin's Gap was not. A lot had changed in the 4 or 5 days since the fort had fallen. For starters, he'd been reinforced by Colonel Michael Stewart's 2nd Glacierheart Volunteers, who'd arrived via the Braneth Canal with the anticipated convoy of ammunition and additional 30-pounders, and the Sidermarkian 10th Independent Brigade coming overland from Sidar City. His total strength was now almost 34,000. Within 2 5-days, it would be 42,000. And when the 3rd Infantry and the rest of his dragoons arrived, it would reach 70,000. Not that he had any intention of letting the Army of Shiloh know that. In the meantime, the fort's broken walls had been further demolished by Carisian engineers, copiously supplied with blasting charges and ably assisted by the Glacierheart miners, until only a few broken tiers of brick rose from drifts of rubble. None were over 4 or 5 feet high, and by a strange coincidence, none of them ran from east to west. The earthworks which had previously guarded the 4th Southern approaches, and those guarding the gap as a whole from the east, had been assaulted by the same energetic workers, aided by thousands of Shilohan volunteers eager to swing a shovel or a pick, and either leveled or incorporated into an entirely new set of south-facing works. Eastchair was too sane to try holding the vast, sprawling defensive works Walkyer had thrown up. Instead, Major Lowell had designed a very different set of fortifications just north of the fort's tattered ruins. Walkyer's works, which had demonstrated his own lack of professional training, had been walls straight across the gap with precious little in the way of flanking fire. Lowell had been granted insufficient time to start from scratch, using all the new techniques which had been worked out by the ICA's engineers and artillerists, but the product of his labors was still formidable. He'd incorporated 2 of Walkyer's earthen curtain walls into the new defenses, but he'd added simple bastions, triangular secondary works in front of the curtains, at regular intervals, well supplied with artillery to sweep the faces of adjoining bastions and the curtain between them. Walkyer's covering ditches had also been improved to offer advanced, covered firing positions for infantry, though there'd been no time to build a proper glacis, and Lowell had built covered wooden bridges as protected routes by which that infantry might retreat into the main work if the enemy broke into the ditch. And, of course, the bridges could be burned to prevent attackers from making use of them. Mortar pits had been dug at regular intervals behind the curtains. Multiple firing positions well to the rear had been prepared for Colonel Sellock's angle guns, and corduroyed roads ensured that the heavy angles could be moved rapidly between them, despite the soft, saturated earth. The Temple Loyalist abatis had also been salvaged for reuse, and given the shorter frontage of Eastshire's works, provided a far denser and more formidable barrier before the ditch. The line across the gap ran for almost 22 miles, reaching up into the foothills proper, where its ends were anchored by a pair of redoubts, each provided with its own artillery, although on a rather less lavish scale than the main position. On the extreme left of his line, the Gray Walls redoubt covered the trail by which Willis's infantry had joined 1st Brigade for the final assault on the fort. That was the only really practical route for a significant body of troops. Eastchair had made certain of that, sending out scout snipers with local guides to survey every cow and lizard path within 30 miles. The redoubt blocked the only one that seriously concerned him, but he'd placed pickets with generous supplies of landmines to cover all of them. He wouldn't want anyone spoiling his surprise for Harless and Alvarez, now would he? Taken all in all, it was a far more challenging obstacle than Walkyer had managed,
manned by a far better armed and trained garrison and with the most lethal artillery in the world to support it. Which was probably just as well, given that the oncoming army of Shiloh still consisted of over 170,000 men, with hundreds of less lethal but still deadly artillery pieces in support. The vanguard of that enormous army was crawling up the gap as Eastshire watched, and he wondered if Duke Harless was stupid enough to try a quick assault. It seemed unlikely. He'd read Earl Hanth's reports describing the bungled night assault on Thesmar, and he found it difficult to imagine that any general who'd lost so many men so uselessly would attempt the same maneuver twice. Still, one could always hope.
"Don't get too full of yourself, Rossu," he reminded himself. "If they ever do punch through anywhere, there'll be more than enough of them to swamp you, at least until Simkin comes up with the third. Not only that, but unlike Walkie's clowns, they've got at least some trained siege engineers over there."
All of that was true, and he had no intention of becoming overconfident or allowing any of his subordinates to fall into the same error. Still, the truth was that he was rather counting on those engineers. Their expertise was sadly out of date, but they probably didn't know that yet, and the weather actually seemed to be improving a bit. Colder, but with longer breaks between bouts of rain. That would offer them significantly better conditions to conduct operations against his position, and he devoutly hoped they'd do just that for at least the next 3 or 4 or 5 days. Sir Reynos Alvarez stood beside his horse, training the heavy spyglass on the heretic's works, and hoped none of his subordinates could see his expression. From what he could see, Colonel Kerbish's wyvern messages had actually understated the situation. Anything which might have offered cover for troops advancing towards the heretics had been carefully demolished. Heaps of broken brickwork showed where the fort had once been, but it had been even more completely wrecked than Alexburg after the garrison blew up their magazines. The heretics obviously had no interest in holding those ruins, and that was more than enough to give him pause. It said things he didn't really want to hear about their attitude towards what had once been one of the most formidable fortifications in the entire Republic of Sidermark. And then there were the earthworks north of the ruins. He couldn't see them very clearly from here, yet what he could see suggested a radical shift in the nature of fortifications in general. He'd seen some of that at Thesmar, but on a smaller, cruder scale, probably because for all the heretic Hanth's tenacity, the man was a marine, trained for shipboard combat, not fortress design. Whoever had laid out these works was a far more formidable engineer, and something with hundreds of icy little feet danced along his spine as he contemplated them. Bastions had been a feature of permanent fortifications for centuries, but not on this scale. They'd been incorporated into castles, usually in the form of towers rather than these low-lying gun platforms, and they'd been close together because missile weapons had been short-ranged and cannon had been huge, bulky, slow-firing, and clumsy. Only a certified lunatic would have depended on old-style artillery to beat off determined infantry. That was what bows, arbalists, and matchlocks had been for, and none of them had been effective at anything over 100 yards. Everyone had known that, which at least partly explained, it did not excuse, for nothing could do that, Harless's assault at Thesmar. He'd known the new artillery and rifles were more deadly, but it had been an intellectual awareness, one which hadn't yet penetrated deeply enough to displace old habits and old calculations. But these works seemed to bristle with artillery. He was positive there were plenty of firing positions for riflemen, but it was the artillery that truly frightened him. It looked as if those bastions were as much as 4,000 yards apart at their greatest separation. That was far too great a range for matchlocks and old-style artillery, but the heretics had demonstrated that their guns could reach that far with deadly effectiveness.
He lowered the spyglass, his mouth grim. He'd wondered why the heretics hadn't tried to delay them in the Kiplinger Forest. He'd found that especially puzzling in light of the skill with which Eastchair, the heretic commander, had used the same sort of terrain against Bishop Militant Conyer in July. Now he understood. There had been no point in digging in among the trees, where it was always possible someone could find an open flank and get around it, no matter how tangled the terrain might be. Not once Fort Terrace had fallen, and one had such a lovely defensive position as O'Hodlin's Gap, which offered no flanks at all. Harless and Hankey were still talking about pushing infantry around the heretics through the hills, but Alvarez had never had much faith in the possibility. He had even less now. A commander who'd chosen that position and erected those fortifications hadn't left any spider-rat holes someone could use against him. Not even Japheth Slate here seemed to be able to get through now, and Alvarez was far from eager to play catch-as-catch-can in the hills with the scout snipers who'd wrought such carnage on Bishop Militant Conyer's troops.
No, he thought. This Eastchair's got Shonway's own cork in this bottle, and I understand exactly what the devious bastard had in mind. Unfortunately for him, he's got an unanticipated little problem of his own now, doesn't he?
Hennett's cavalry were indeed ranging north along the Braneth Canal, although Eastchair had been too canny to leave pickets out where Hennett could get at them. In fact, the whole time he'd been using the canal to move his troops south, he'd been using the same barges to move civilians north, out of harm's way, on the return trip. And he'd been very thorough. Just as he'd been thorough about emptying every barn and granary between Carmick and Fort St. Clair. It sounded very much as if Eastchair's troops could have given the faithful lessons in how to strip a countryside bare of anything that might support an invading army. Starvation and disease among the besiegers had been the bane of too many sieges as supplies ran out. Eastchair had obviously intended to deploy those weapons against the army of Shiloh, and Alvarez was unhappily certain that the already parlous state of that army's supplies was about to get even worse far more quickly than Harless expected.
But that works both ways, doesn't it? He told himself. And Eastchair just got a little too clever this time. Not that knowing about his problems does much about ours, and we're heading into the middle of winter. A lot milder winter than anything farther north, but still winter. And too many of Harless's troops are already ready to eat their boots and belts. It's going to get worse, a lot worse, with the way Eastchair's stripped the countryside, and we're damned near 900 miles from Thesmar. How the hell are the frigging Desnarians supposed to haul supplies 900 miles overland when they've got less than half, hell, less than a third of the wagons they need? An army that depends on foragers needs to keep moving, needs to keep advancing into territory that hasn't been stripped of food, and that's exactly what Eastchair's counting on. He and Baron Templar had done what they could, but even the secondary route along the St. Alec was inefficient at best. Yet even while they worked to improve their own logistics, the Desnarians got only worse. They were losing scores of draft dragons to exhaustion, overwork, and hunger, and each one they lost took another bite out of their transport capacity. Worse, even the portion of their supply line being managed by the church was in disarray. The heretics had total control of the Gulf of Jaras, and the miserable excuse of a high road around its western shore had been cut in at least 6 places. All shipments from Desnair now had to cross the southern lobe of the Gulf of Dolar, and to make bad worse, 2 of those damnable armored ships had arrived in Silkia Bay. They'd closed the eastern end of the Southar Canal, requiring every ton of supplies to travel almost 60 miles overland between the Southar and the Silktown Thesmar Canal, which required still more draft animals and wagons. Wherever he looked, Harless's ability to supply his troops was eroding still further, and there was only so much assistance even a wizard like Templar could provide. They simply could not, adequately feed this many men and this many animals under these conditions.
At the very least, they should send as much cavalry as possible back to Thesmar. They needed to retain some of it, if only for flank security, but it would be virtually useless in any sort of siege, and each damned horse ate 10 times as much as a man. Surely even Hanky and Hennet had to realize that.
Don't count on it, Renos, he thought glumly.
Hennet'll swell up like a swamp hopper in mating season if you even suggest sending his precious horsemen to the rear. Obviously, the only reason you'd be suggesting it would be to see to it that the despicable infantry, your infantry, gets the glory for securing the gateway to Shiloh while he gets left out in the cold.
He sighed and admitted that he'd have been thinking in much the same patterns not so very long ago. Of course, he wasn't Desnarian. That meant he could learn from experience when it hit him over the head with a heavy enough club.
Time to sit down with Shulman, he told himself. When Hollis's men get hungry enough, they're going to expect us to feed them. Sir Boris is hopelessly out of his depth, even with Casimar working himself to death trying to cover for him. So, as the only quartermaster with a clue as to what he's doing, it'll all come down on Shulman when the situation starts going into... further into the crapper.
He grimaced at the unfairness of expecting his own quartermaster to shoulder such a burden, but pretending he had any alternative would be stupid. And at least they'd have the St. Alec River open for barge traffic, despite the formidable obstacles, in another 5 day or so. That would help a lot. Whether it would help enough was a very different question, however, and it was entirely possible they'd finally encountered a problem not even the redoubtable Sir Shulman Rogers could solve. But if he couldn't solve it, no one could. Which meant that, fair or not, Alvarez was going to have to ask him to do it. And, he reminded himself, the army of Shiloh's quartermasters weren't the only ones having problems. He raised his spyglass once more, glowering at those fortifications, and treasured those wyvern-born messages.
You plan to sit there behind those earthworks with your own provisions arriving securely through Maidenburg while we starved out here at the end of our so-called supply line. But a sword has 2 edges, my heretical friend, he thought grimly, and you shouldn't have let Kerbish get away. Now we'll just see who starves first.
Chapter 2 Nemu's Cave, The Mountains of Light, The Temple Lands. She woke up, which was odd, because she didn't remember going to sleep. Sapphire eyes opened, then narrowed, as she saw the curve of a glass-smooth stone ceiling above her. She lay on her back on a table of some sort, her hands folded across her chest, and she'd never seen this room before in her life. She tried to sit up, and the narrowed eyes flared wide when she discovered that she couldn't.
Hello, Nemu. A deep, resonant voice she'd never heard before said, and she found she could turn her head after all. She did, and found herself looking at someone she'd never met, but who seemed somehow familiar, despite his bizarre appearance. It wasn't the long hair or the mustachios and dagger beard. The Terran Federation Navy's personnel favored short hair, and its male personnel were mostly clean-shaven, but neither braids nor beards were unheard of. For that matter, there were still civilians, even now, and compared to many of them, this fellow's styling was almost bland. Facial scars like the one on his cheek weren't exactly unheard of among serving personnel either. But even granting all of that, she couldn't quite recall the last time she'd seen someone in what appeared to be a blackened steel breastplate, chainmail, wide-legged black trousers bloused into high, polished boots, and a matching tunic with slashed sleeves. The breastplate bore a complicated heraldic device in blue, white, black, and gold, boasting some opium dream of a fish or
possibly an octopus, or possibly a fish performing some sort of unnatural act upon an octopus. It made her think about an old pre-space book she'd read once by a man named Lovecraft. And he was amazingly tall. Nemu stood just over 190 centimeters in height, but he was at least 20 centimeters taller than she was. It was hard to be sure of her estimate while lying flat on her back, but the differential had to be at least that great, which only added to the grotesqueness of his appearance. She was accustomed to being taller than the vast majority of men she met. Certainly, if she'd ever met this long-haired, broad-shouldered, slightly battered giant, she'd remember him. She didn't. And yet there was that strange familiarity, almost as if she did know him, which was ridiculous. She couldn't possibly have forgotten. Her thoughts hiccuped to a sudden halt as a pair of impossibilities abruptly registered. The first was that she was inside her pika, with absolutely no memory of planning to find herself there. The second was that something was missing from her field of vision. The 10-day clock counting down how long she had to record her updated personality before it was automatically scrubbed. The possibility of her pika's being activated by someone else, without her knowledge and active cooperation, was scary enough, given that the lockouts and security systems were supposed to be absolutely unbreakable. Yet frightening as that was, the missing clock was almost worse. She couldn't even begin to count the laws, regulations, protocols, and prohibitions its absence violated. "Who are you?" she asked finally, and the stranger smiled oddly. The sense of familiarity grew still stronger, and yet she remained positive she'd never seen that face, with its scarred cheek and pronounced chin. "Interesting you should ask," he said. He reached behind him and drew a tall, rolling stool closer to the surface upon which she lay and settled onto it. "Interesting you should ask," he repeated in a softer voice. "Because the truth is, I used to be you." Nemu Albon stood on the balcony beside the man who called himself Merlin Athrawus, gazing out over the enormous cavern, trying to grapple with the hurricane of emotions and thoughts ripping through her. Her head barely topped Merlin's shoulder, but not because he was so enormously tall, after all. He truly was 11 inches, she corrected herself, taller than she was, but only because she was 11 inches shorter than she remembered being. She felt like a midget, but he'd explained the reason for it readily enough. "People average shorter on Safehold than in the Federation," he'd said in that deep male voice which sounded nothing at all like hers, until she listened carefully. "We were too tall to be anything except male. I'm only 2 or 3 inches above the norm for some of the more northern portions of the planet, but the average male height in the Out Islands is only about 5'7", and of course, the one thing a pika can't adjust is its height. You're 5'4", a bit short for a man, but close enough to the norm that you could pass for whichever you choose." He'd smiled again, that worn smile that spoke of experiences she'd never had. "I've encountered a few problems in becoming permanently male, and I figured this way we could at least spare you that much. Besides," he laughed suddenly, "nobody's ever going to mistake the two of us for the same person now." It was going to take some getting used to, but he was certainly right about that. And "take some getting used to" was a pretty good description of everything she'd discovered in the last few hours. She closed her eyes, feeling the faint stir of the cavern's circulating air on her face, and ran her mind carefully, trying to avoid the razor edges of so much grief, so much loss experienced with such brutal swiftness, back over those hours. She replayed the last message from Commodore Pei,
feeling another tiny shiver as she realized the man beside her had seen exactly the same message, felt exactly the same emotions she had. She replayed what Merlin, the AI named Owl, whose avatar resembled both of them so much, and the short, plump virtual personality named Narman had told her after that. It would take time to come to grips with that enormous flood of data, yet it was at her command, as was the later imagery of the brutal war savaging the Republic of Siddermark. The war she'd started. No, I didn't start it. Merlin Athrawes did. Her mind spun with the strangeness of the concept. I would have if he hadn't, though. I don't see any other way he could have approached the problem, even without this millennial return of the archangels to worry about. He couldn't have broken the church's tyranny any other way. With the archangels' return, he has even less time to create a situation that can't be uncreated. But I didn't have to start anything. He did. She thought about that, about the fact that the undeniably male person standing beside her was her. But 7 years and God alone knew how many deaths, how many losses older. And as she stood there, she knew the real reason he'd recorded such a limited update to her personality recording, one that had nothing at all to do with the loss of his high-speed port, whatever he might say. I didn't have time to record everything if we were going to get you up and running quickly, but I've installed some updates to your muscle memory package, he'd said, and smiled crookedly. Little things like marksmanship, the difference between using a katana for serious combat as opposed to kendo, how to ride a horse, which fork to reach for at a formal dinner, safeholdian salutes and military courtesies, things like that. Wouldn't do to have you falling off a horse the way I did the first few times I practiced. In private, fortunately. You've got the local dialects from Owl and the remotes, and Owl has complete records on everything I've done over the last few years, but I decided it would be better not to weigh you down with a lot of memories that could only get in the way of establishing your own persona. You've got the information you need, and the skills, but I think it's important our public personalities and reactions to people who have already met Merlin be as distinct from each other as possible. It makes sense, she thought, with a sudden surge of compassion for the person she would never become. It makes a lot of sense, but that's not the reason he did it. I wonder if this iteration of Nemu Alban will grow into someone that unwilling to burden someone else with so much pain. She reached out, and up, she noted wryly, to rest her hand on his mailed forearm. On one level, it felt unnatural. That was the level which knew Merlin Athrawes had been born Nemu Alban, however. On a much deeper level, helped along by the fact of his masculinity, it felt completely natural. Not as if she were touching herself, but as if she were touching the brother, the older brother, she'd never had, who'd never been allowed to exist on a world which knew it was doomed. Yes? He arched an eyebrow at her, and she smiled up at him. It was a little wavery, that smile, but it was genuine as well. I recognize where that eyebrow started from, she told him. It's been some places I haven't since, though. Gotten more panache along the way. Panache, he repeated, as if tasting the word. I suppose that's one thing I've gotten more of along the line. More dings, dents, scrapes, and scratches, too. He shook his head. Safehold's a high wear environment, Nemu, but there are so many things here worth defending. And that need changing, too. I know. She squeezed his forearm. It's going to take some getting used to, you understand? She chuckled suddenly. Well, of course you understand. Her humor disappeared as quickly as it had come. And knowing what happened to Shan Wei, the Commodore, all of them, that's going to take getting used to, too. I can't say I don't find the mission you and I have both signed on for, or didn't sign on for, maybe, since neither of us remembers volunteering, a bit daunting. But a lot of good people died so you and I could stand here to have this conversation. More of them, some of them people you know and I haven't met yet, will die before it's over, too. That's hard, Merlin. A lot of me wants to run away from it. But you didn't. So how can this version of me, of us, do what you didn't? And when you come down to it, even if the odds really sucked when you started out, even if they're not all that great even now, given this millennial visit we're looking forward to, they're one hell of a lot better than what we had when the only possible future was the Gababa killing all of us. She looked up, sapphire eyes meeting identical eyes, and her nostrils flared. If you were crazy enough to take this on, so am I. After all, she smiled again. The expression blended from grief, loss, determination, and humor. Who am I to argue with me?
Chapter 3. Port Royal, Kingdom of Chisholm, Empire of Chorus.
So, Joseph, are we going to get this done on schedule or not?
Sir Luke Coleman, the Earl of Sharpfield, inquired.
What's that saying of Sage and Merlin's?
Admiral Joseph Hurst responded with an off-center smile.
The difficult we do immediately, the impossible takes a little longer, isn't it?
I believe it is.
Sharpfield returned his subordinate smile.
So does this come under the heading of difficult or impossible?
I think the proper label is probably extremely difficult, my lord. But after all, we've got an entire 5 day before we're scheduled to sail. I'm sure we can work whatever miracles we need with that much time in hand.
Hurst climbed out of his office chair and gestured a polite invitation for the silver-haired Earl to accompany him to the window that looked out across the waters of Port Royal. Those waters weren't as frenetic as they'd been when the Empire had been concentrating on shipping everybody in an army uniform off to Sittermark, but they were busy enough to go on with.
As you can see, my lord, we've accumulated almost all the transports we need. Actually, finding the troops to put into them is a bit more problematical, you understand, but I'm taking the High Admiral's word for it that the necessary marines will arrive any day now. The colliers are already here, and we'll have the last of the coal loaded by the end of this 5 day, although I've discovered we need more supply ships than we'd thought we would when this was all just a gleam in the High Admiral's eye. It always does seem to work out that way, which is why I'm not surprised to be running around like a wyvern with its tail on fire scraping up additional galleons. It would help if we hadn't sent everything that would float off to the Republic, but it looks like we've gotten enough additional old Carisian hulls to compensate. We'll have enough escorts to keep an eye on things, too, and I might as well admit that having Thunderer and Dreadnought along makes me feel a lot more comfortable when I contemplate the operation. Not that I wouldn't just as soon have the first of the King Heralds instead. Of course, that's rather the point, I imagine.
Hurst's lips twitched another smile, and Sharpfield snorted. Not that it was really all that humorous, the Earl supposed, remembering a terrifying day of thunder and smoke and the reek of brimstone drifting across Darko Sound. He'd commanded Queen Charlion's navy in that battle, and he'd known how bitterly she'd resented being dragged into Hector Dakin's alliance against the Kingdom of Chorus. That had made his decision easier when he realized how outclassed any galley was by the Royal Carisian Navy's new cannon-armed galleons. It would have been easier still if he hadn't known how Jaspar Clinton and the Inquisition were likely to react to his order for his ships to strike their colors. Fortunately, his queen was a very smart woman who'd made the right decision when Caleb of Chorus proposed marriage, and it would be good to take the battle back to the enemy, especially since this time it would be the right enemy, he thought. He'd never wanted to fight Chorus, and he deeply regretted King Harald's death at Darko Sound. He felt rather differently where the temple and its minions were concerned, however,
and he had an intensely personal score to settle with the Royal Dalaran Navy, one that had quite a lot to do with Darko Sound, or its aftermath at least, as a matter of fact. He'd never met Brian Lock Island or Gwilym Monthir before his surrender. He'd come to know both of them well afterward, though, and despite the death of their beloved king, and the fact that both of them had known precisely what Clinton had intended to do to their homes and families, they'd seen to it that their prisoners were treated with respect. They'd allowed surrendered officers to retain their swords, permitted no brutality, provided healers, and plucked every survivor they could from the Sound's waters. They'd become Sharpfield's friends, not simply his captors, and Lock Island had welcomed Sharpfield as the new Imperial Carisian Navy's second-ranking admiral following the merger of Old Carus, Chisholm, and Emerald. Now they were dead. Lock Island had at least been granted the gift of dying, fighting for his emperor and empress and all the things in which he believed, in a battle that crushed the Navy of God and the Imperial Harchong-Yi's Navy. Monthir had not, and Sharpfield felt the familiar rage flicker as he remembered what the Inquisition had done to his friend and the men under his command. Men of the same Carisian Navy which had always granted quarter to its enemies treated them with common decency, as if they were actually human beings. And it was Thirsk and his precious King Ronild who handed Gwilym and his men to that pig Clinton, the Earl thought now, gazing blindly out across the busy harbor. I'm pretty sure it wasn't Thirsk's idea, but there's a price for something like that, whether it's your idea or not, and I'm not the only officer in Their Majesty's Navy who wants a little payback. A lot of payback, actually. He wasn't going to collect that payback any time in the immediate future, not in full, but in about another month, assuming Hurst pulled off his very difficult job, Sir Luke Coleman and the Imperial Carisian Navy would be making their first down payment on that particular debt. His eyes focused once more, taking in the bombardment ships, HMS Tumult and Turmoil, and, beyond them, the armored sides of HMS Thunderer and HMS Dreadnought. The ironclads were sisters of HMS Rottweiler, just as well protected and just as heavily armed as she was, and he'd long since decided Dreadnought would be his flagship. After all, what could be more fitting than to return to the Gulf of Dolar in a ship named for the galleon Gwilym Monthir had commanded so brilliantly and lost at the Battle of Darko Sound? You may not be here to see it, my friend, he thought, looking at those closed gun ports, thinking of the cannon crouching behind them, and his smile was thin and cold. But wherever you are instead, Gwilym, I promise you this. Those bastards will hear your voice in Gorath before we're finished. Chapter 4. West of O'Hodlan's Gap, the South March Lands, Republic of Sidermark.
What?
Sir Reynos Alvarez heard the shock in his own voice as he gazed at Colonel Thomas Gardner. His astonishment, and the fear he couldn't quite keep out of his tone, were unlikely to do his reputation for calmness in the face of adversity any favors, but that was the least of his worries at the moment.
Major Tibbet's scouts got a good look, sir.
Gardner's voice was calmer than Alvarez's had been, probably because he'd had longer for the news to settle in during his long ride from the Karmic Semaphore Station.
They say the riders they saw were definitely in Carisian ponchos and helmets.
I hate to ask this, but how reliable is Tibbet?
He's a good, solid young company commander, sir. That's one reason I picked him for the detachment, and the sergeant who actually saw them's as steady as any trooper I've ever known. According to Tibbet's semaphore message, he was carrying a spyglass as well. That's how he got such a good look. And Tibbet says the sergeant's fairly sure the heretics didn't spot him before he pulled his patrol back and rode like hell for Bronselik.
Alvarez nodded approvingly. There weren't all that many spyglasses available, but he'd collected up all he could, much to the disgruntlement of his infantry commanders, for the cavalry patrols he'd deployed to cover the 75-mile gap between the Kiplinger Forest and the small, sleepy town of Bronselik on the upper reaches of the St. Alec River. He hadn't mentioned them to Duke Harless, who'd probably have seen them as fresh proof of Dalaran timidity, and he'd been more than half convinced himself that it was pointless. It seemed preposterous to worry about a threat 300 miles and more in the army of Shiloh's rear when the enemy was in front of it. Even if the heretics had somehow miraculously created a force to send to Eastshire's support, they wouldn't have sent it that far west. Surely it would be moving through Shiloh to clear his communications, not threatening the army of Shiloh's. He'd known all that. Yet none of it had been quite enough to silence his nagging awareness of how important that sleepy town had become. It was a pity Harless seemed so unaware of it. The original plan to haul every ton of supplies overland from Thesmar had been predicated on several assumptions. One, laughable in retrospect, had been that Sir Boris Kostner's Desnarian quartermasters would be able to move a sufficient quantity of supplies to Karmic. Another had been that because a 62-mile stretch of the St. Alec was unnavigable immediately north of Cirque, with no road net to cover the gap, the river was an impractical supply route. Once they'd realized the truly disastrous state of Kostner's wagon trains, however, Alvarez and Templar had quietly reconsidered the St. Alec. In fact, they'd started reconsidering it before Thesmar was out of sight, with the result that General Richter had been ordered to dispatch 8,000 civilian laborers to carve out a roadway paralleling the unnavigable stretch of the St. Alec, build a fleet of rafts north of it, since all his proper barges were trapped below Cirque, and improvise loading docks at Cirque and again at Bronselik. He was an energetic man, and the army of Shiloh's advance to Karmic had been so lethargic he'd been able to complete his improvements about the time Harless began active operations against Fort Terrace. Templar was still in the process of getting things fully organized, and the arrangement wasn't anything Alvarez would have been tempted to call efficient, but it was Shanwei's own lot more efficient than anything Harless boasted. As of 2 5-days ago, the distance from Alvarez's canal head, well, river head in this case, to Karmic had been more than cut in half, to little more than 370 miles. 170 of those miles were along a less than excellent secondary road from Bronselik to the town of Roymark, 25 miles west of Kiplinger, but it effectively doubled the number of his wagons by halving the distance they had to travel. It put more strain on the overall transport system in his rear, and his own supply situation was scarcely anything he would have dignified with the adjective good even now, yet it had been vastly improved. He hadn't liked the thought of leaving his new supply line unprotected, which was why he'd sent the Honorable Fedor Martin, one of his best infantry colonels, to command the Bronselik garrison. It was also the reason he deployed his cavalry northwest of the forest, seen to it that the semaphore towers between Roymark and Karmic were repaired, and built a new line between Roymark and Bronselik. The Desnarians had been simply delighted to leave that little task to their Dalaran allies. Their efforts and fatigue parties were focused on getting into Fort Terrace. If Alvarez wanted to wear his own men out felling trees and building towers out of green wood in the middle of the winter, that was his affair. "And a damned good thing somebody worried about putting the line back into service," he told himself grimly. "Where exactly did Tibbet's sergeant spot them?" he asked now, laying his palm flat on the map spread out on his camp table. "About here, sir." Gardner indicated a spot approximately 150 miles northeast of Roymark, just south of the South March Cliff Peak border, and barely 70 miles east of Bronselik. "Which way did they seem to be headed?"
"Roughly southwest, sir."
"Southwest?" Alvarez repeated a bit sharply. "Not due west?"
"No, sir." Gardner looked up from the map. "Not towards Bronselik."
Alvarez nodded as at least one of his concerns was at least partially relieved, Unless, of course, additional forces Major Tibbetts' sergeant hadn't seen were headed west to burn Bronzelik to the ground. It seemed unlikely the heretics could have learned about the supply route, but the new riverhead would be a lovely target for a cavalry raid if they had. Its garrison consisted of less than 4,000 men, 3 infantry regiments, all at least a little under strength, supported only by his tenuous cavalry screen. Still, how fast were they moving?
Not really pushing the pace, sir. I wish I could give you a better estimate, but the best the sergeant could tell Major Tibbetts was that while he had them under observation, they were moving at no more than a slow walk and paused completely for 20 or 30 minutes to graze their horses.
So one problem gets less worrisome, and the other one gets a hell of a lot worse, Alvarez reflected. Any cavalry sent to raid Bronzelik would ride as hard and fast as it could to hit its objective. All of northern and central Cliff Peak was firmly in the faithful's hands, despite the Army of God's reserves along the Divan. The apostate held the southeastern corner of the province, which was how Eastchair had managed to move his forces down the Branath Canal without being spotted. But Bishop Militant Conyer still had more than enough cavalry to intercept even a fast-moving cavalry raid. The fact that the Carisian troopers hadn't been pushing the pace suggested they weren't part of a quickly-in, quickly-out raid on Bronzelik. He wished he could decide that was a good thing.
"And it was a small party?" he asked.
"Yes, sir. No more than a single section. Major Tibbetts suggests they might be part of a screen for a bigger force."
Alvarez nodded again, completely understanding the unhappiness in the colonel's voice and expression. If Tibbetts was right, and if Eastchair had both the manpower and the nerve to try it...
"Nerve?" He glowered silently down at the map. "The son of a bitch may be short on manpower, but one thing he's not short on is nerve. What he did to Bishop Militant Cunn is proof enough of that, even without Fort Terrace. He knows by now how badly he screwed up, but would even he have the sheer audacity to try digging himself out that way?"
Harless had been content to let Alvarez's infantry make the initial probing advance into the gap, and the heretics' artillery-strewn defenses had been just as deadly as he'd feared. He'd lost over 1,000 men establishing that to Harless's satisfaction, but at least the Duke had been willing to accept the proof of those broken bodies, and Earl Hankey's notion of sweeping across the parapets had been quietly abandoned in favor of a more methodical approach. Technically, Eastchair was now under siege. It was a rather peculiar siege, given that the army of Shiloh was unable to surround his position, but that didn't mean it couldn't be effective, because the heretics had overreached. They'd rolled the dice boldly when they seized Fort Terrace, yet in the process, Eastchair had put his entire force into a trap, and his decision to let Hennett's cavalry have free run of the Branath Canal only made it worse. It was difficult to fault the man's logic, but even the vaunted Carisians could make mistakes. Eastchair had abandoned the Branath to Hennett because he'd expected to be supplied overland, down the high road from Maidenburg. Wagons would be less efficient than barges, but they'd be efficient enough, and securely on the far side of the mountains from the army of Shiloh. Unfortunately for him, they weren't on the far side of the mountains from Colonel Bryan Kerbish. The Shilohan faithful's partisans had rallied to him after his escape from Fort Terrace, and their unceasing raids had wreaked havoc on Eastchair's intended supply route. By now, the heretic supply situation was even worse than the army of Shiloh's. By Kerbish's best estimate, which accorded well with everything the besiegers had seen themselves, Eastchair had no more than 17,000 men, 20,000 at the outside, and virtually no food was getting through to him. He'd undoubtedly stockpiled as much as he could before giving up the Branath Canal, but he hadn't known, then, that Kerbish would succeed in cutting his own supply line, and hunger had to be biting deep over there by now. All the army of Shiloh had to do was hold on a little longer, and the trap Eastchair had planned for it would close on him instead. But the heretics had to know that as well as Alvarez did, and he had to assume they'd move heaven and earth to save themselves. The question was what they might be able to use in the attempt. According to the Inquisition's agents, the entire Imperial Carizian army was no more than 200,000 men strong, and obviously some of it had to be kept home to hold down the faithful in conquered territories like Taro, Zebediah, and, especially, Coruscant. Bearing all of that in mind, there had to be a limit on how many men the heretics could send, and the army of Shiloh all by itself probably had more manpower than everything Caleb and Charlian could scrape up for the mainland. But if they'd managed to get only another 45,000 or so men into Sittermark, and if Eastchair truly was gutsy enough...
"Very well, Colonel," he said at last, looking up from the map. "Pass my thanks to Major Tibbet, then take the rest of your regiment and Colonel Wickman's to reinforce the patrols as quickly as possible. I'll send 2 or 3 regiments of infantry to reinforce Roymark, but they'll need the better part of a 5-day to get there. I'll also instruct General Richter to send reinforcements to Colonel Martin, but even with the St. Alec available, they'll take at least 2 5-days to reach him from Trevor, so I want you to pay special attention to the approaches to Bronselik. I'll see if I can't convince Duke Harless to send a few thousand of his cavalry to support you as well."
"Thank you, sir." From his tone, it was just remotely possible Gardner was less reassured by the prospect of Desnarian cavalry support than an ally ought to have been.
"I'll be on the road within the hour."
"Good, Colonel. Very good. Captain Latimer will see to it that Roymark's warned to expect you." He nodded in dismissal, and Gardner withdrew, leaving him to bend back over the map and contemplate a whole host of unpalatable suspicions. After several moments, he straightened, rubbed the muscles at the small of his back, and stepped to the fly of his tent. It was considerably brisker outside. At least the drenching fall rains had abated, but the ground remained soft and muddy, as the booted feet and shod hooves of almost 200,000 infantry and cavalry made abundantly clear. Of course, the ground might have dried further and faster if it hadn't frozen over every night. They'd had one bitter 3-day cold snap, complete with sleet and freezing rain, but on average, the daytime temperatures climbed as much as 15 or even 20 degrees above the freezing point. Indeed, it was warm enough this afternoon to require little more than a light jacket. But those temperatures dropped overnight. In fact, he rather thought they might drop considerably and stay there for a while, given the northwest breeze and clear, icy blue sky. But even average temperatures left a heavy frost and ground that tended to crunch underfoot every morning. That freeze and thaw cycle was hard on the men's health, and he shook his head, wishing the weather could be either consistently warmer or consistently cold enough to freeze the damp out of the air and get rid of that enervating edge of rawness. The Desnarians were poorly provided with heavy winter clothing, so he supposed he should be grateful they weren't experiencing the sort of weather more northern portions of the Republic must be enduring. Still, the contrast between shivering all night and sweating in no more than a tunic by midday wore on a man. And then there was the matter of diet. The cavalry's horses were suffering especially badly, but even the infantry was on short rations. Very short rations, in the Desnarian's case. It was only a matter of time before Harless demanded Alvarez make up the shortfall in his own men's rations. "Of course he will. And once you get past the fact that his shortages are entirely his own fault, and that you can't feed his men and yours properly without one hell of a lot more wagons, even with the line to Bronselik open and Shulman running your supply train, it even makes sense. I wish it didn't, but it does. In fact, I should have made the offer already. Hell, I probably would have made it if I weren't so pissed off with him for refusing to at least send half his useless freaking cavalry to the rear. And while I'm being pissed off about that, I guess I should be pissed off that it's not already back there to support Gardner and the rest of my cavalry." He suppressed an urge to hawk up a mouthful of phlegm and spit in disgust. It might make him feel better, but there were probably hundreds of eyes looking in his direction right now, and Camp Rumor was the only thing known to man that moved faster than Langhorne's own Rakurai. It wouldn't do to reveal his unhappiness quite so clearly immediately before he called for his horse and headed off for another delightful tete-a-tete with his esteemed army commander. Chapter 5. Monchir Palace, City of Monchir, Princedom of Coruscant. Sir Corin Garvey climbed the final flight of stairs and headed down the sun-drenched corridor on the fourth floor of Monchir Palace's north wing. The original architect had faced conflicting requirements. The palace had been intended and needed as a serious fortress a century ago when it was first built, but Prince Hector's great-grandfather had wanted something a bit more comfortable than another towering heap of stone. So he'd insisted on what amounted to tucking away a large, luxurious mansion in the middle of one of those towering heaps of stone, with a result which had inevitably been neither kraken nor wyvern. The curtain wall, moat, and bastion towers of a large, powerful fortress wrapped around something just too small to call a cathedral. The palace had served its function, both its functions, well, although not necessarily equally well. Only an idiot would have considered attacking its formidable defenses, yet those high, forbidding walls and towers had completely blocked the mansion's windows, cast it into shadow for all but 2 or 3 hours in the middle of the day, when the temperature was at its most stifling, and deprived the ruling family's personal dwelling place of any hint of breeze. 2 generations of the House of Dakin put up with it. The present prince's father, however, had decided enough was enough and levied a special tax to raise the funds to do something about it. The southern seaward walls had been raised, replaced by an entirely new set of lower artillery-armed walls rising sheer out of the harbor's water on a footing of crushed stone and seashell. The original eastern and western walls had also been demolished, replaced by more extensive walls, much farther apart, which ran back to join the new waterfront defenses and effectively doubled the enclosed area. The northern wall, which faced Cathedral Square and formed the rear wall of the south-facing residential section, had been left intact. Since it was 30 feet thick, there had been little way to improve the backside of the north wing, but its southern facade had been heavily remodeled, and an entirely new fourth floor had been added, an open, airy confection with skylights, a colorful tile roof embellished with dozens of ventilator domes, a wide expanse of windows facing the palace's main courtyard, and a plethora of balconies offering a spectacular view of Monchir Harbor over the lower waterfront batteries. Cutting down the original curtain walls and moving the new ones farther out had also allowed far more sunlight, and, thank God, breeze, to reach the interior. What had been a cobblestoned parade ground had become a colorful landscaped garden, and the new administrative wing on the western side of the garden shared the sunlight, the view of the harbor, and the breeze.
"And a damn good thing, too, all of it," Garvey thought as he strode down the hallway. "It's bad enough on a calm day even now. I hate to even think what it must have been like when they couldn't get any of that breeze in here."
He chuckled and then laughed out loud, albeit softly, as he savored the knowledge that he could find something in this palace to chuckle about. He paused, gazing out one of the row of windows which turned the hallway's southern side into a wall of glass, and thought about that. It was very quiet, probably because the upper floor was reserved for the royal family, and, at the moment, the royal family had been reduced to only 2 members. Well, 3, counting Princess Iris's new husband. Even after housing their secular guests from Old Karras, that left a vast quantity of empty, unused space.